Hello and welcome to the Interior Health Nursing Grand Rounds, a podcast conversation. I am your host, Allison Thomas, and on this podcast, we talk all things nursing and healthcare. I work as the clinical nurse specialist in the Trauma Services Network in Interior Health. Interior Health would like to recognize and acknowledge the traditional, ancestral, and unceded territories of the Dakal Dene, Tanaha, Ingla Katma, Shawepim, Shtatlium, Siouxs, and Chukultin nations, where we live, learn, collaborate, and work together. And today, Pam and I continue the conversation about neurologic assessment. I worked with this nurse who, when I graduated, I was 21. So I thought that everyone I worked with was like 100 years old, right? And I worked with this nurse who I thought was really old. And she would tell me about, you know, at night shift, how everybody QCs the glucometers. That's part of your routine at night. And she would say, well, you know, Allison, when I started nursing, we used to sharpen the needles at night that we'd reprocessed. And you can imagine, right? I thought, oh, this is medieval times. And I just can't wait to be a nurse approaching my retirement, sitting in a room with somebody. And I just wonder what the things are going to be that we tell them that the practice used to be this, and they're going to be horrified, right? Because we think right now, we're only doing what we think is best for our patients, but we're going to learn in the years to come that there's probably practices that we're doing right now that go on to, we find better ways or things change and evolve, right? And so it's exactly as you laid out, that was appropriate previously and is no longer appropriate. And I think it's a little bit funny to think about how that's going to be in the future. What's going to be my nipple twist in the future?
Oh,
stay
totally.
Tuned.
Yeah. Well, and I'm always shocked by those people who said that they nursed without gloves for years.
Exactly, right?
You know, yeah. Cleaning up the cold grounds. It's incredible. And it took a patient voice to point out how ridiculous we are as healthcare providers. So I think in that episode, you know, it was a lot of people coming forward to say, we feel assaulted. Rightly so. And we see that in the delirium literature as well, where people sort of report feeling like what we did to insert a Foley catheter made them, in essence, have post-traumatic stress to the sort of tune of feeling raped by healthcare providers. And so we really need to listen to our patients, I think, and be careful about what we deem to be routine medical practice and how it's received by people who receive our care, because boy, do they have some powerful messages for us to learn from. Nipple twist being one of them. Okay, so when we move on in the Glasgow Coma Scale, we have verbal response. And so you were sort of saying, you know, A and O times three, are they orientated? So person, time, place, which is perfect. But I mean, there's a lot in there that you can try to figure out, well, what is orientation? And so usually people will try to ask the question, you know, where are you and what's the date, or what's your name and where are you? And so we will sort of lose things in predictable patterns in a neuro patient. And the last thing we're going to lose is, who are you? So in effect, it's not a useful question. If you ask me my name, I should probably hold on to that right until the end when I become completely neurologically deranged. So just try to switch it up. And I think a lot of people cheat, right? When you have a neuro injury, you sort of have these neuro defense mechanisms where you try to protect yourself and you don't want people to know that you're not doing well. So if you ask them, you know, what day is it and where are you, they're going to read on the whiteboard behind them what the date is. Or they're going to get smart and know that every 4 hours you're coming in to ask these very same questions every time. And so they then take it upon themselves to ask their family, hey, what is the date? Because my nurse is going to ask me. And so they have figured out the pattern, and therefore your question is rendered useless. You no longer have the ability to determine, is the brain functioning or not, because they've just figured out a workaround. So to get by that, you're just trying to figure out, can I switch up the questions? And if I do, will I get earlier information about if the patient deteriorates? So Just play around with what you ask them. You know, what is the season? What is the month? Who is the prime minister? And I have a funny story because I remember sitting in a neuroassessment with my granny. She wasn't doing well at sort of end of life. And they would ask her, who's the prime minister? And she would say Trudeau. And everyone would be like, yep, she's bang on. And I would say, which Trudeau? What's his first name? And she blew it. She didn't know. And so it was so close and sneaky, but she ultimately didn't have orientation to, you know, time anymore. So it was kind of funny. Anyway, so that's kind of the verbal response that you can kind of get. And then when we move into motor response, I think there's some classic things that we get wrong. So obeying commands is clear as day. You know, people will give you the thumbs up, squeeze your hand, whatever you want them to do. I always feel like there's, specifically with the neuro trauma patient, like they will flip you the bird all the time if you ask them this question. And I think, bang on, people, like you are completely orientated. So they know what's up and they're not interested in your silly games anymore. But so that's easy. When you move into localizing, I think people get localizing and withdraw a little bit confused every once in a while. So if we apply stimuli, what that means for a motor response is that people can identify where the stimuli is and then try to isolate exactly the location and defend themselves and push it away. So for example, if I do a sternal rub, the patient theoretically should be able to find my hand and get it away from themselves. That would be localizing. And generally in neuro patients, I like to see if they can cross midline with their motor power as well. So I do kind of watch for that as an incidental. When they're withdrawing, in general, they know there's pain, but they don't know where it's coming from. So they kind of start wiggling around in bed and backing up, trying to get away from it. But they don't have a clue specifically where that pain is, and they can't get it away from themselves with accuracy. So that, to me, would be withdraw. And then we sort of have extension posturing or sort of, you know, decorticate or decerebrate is what we used to call it. So, and I like those, we've moved away from those terms for abnormal flexion and extension, but abnormal flexion comes after we fail with withdrawal. So it will go obey commands, localizes, withdraws from pain, and then it will go to abnormal sort of flexion. And when we flex, we pull things into the core. So that's why I like that term decorticate, because it meant that we would pull things into the core. And you can imagine that person sort of bringing their arm up, you know, towards them, sort of like their face. And that's really what people present like. And decerebrate, we know it's an abnormal extension, which is the worst finding that we can see on a neuro assessment. And essentially, they just have really rigid arms and they sort of extend them out or legs out. And that really means sort of a lower brainstem injury. So, you know, in terms of hierarchy of derangement, we think that extension would be the worst one, and then there would be no response. So the Glasgow Coma Scale is kind of all of those things. It was initially sort of developed as a trauma scale. And, you know, a lot of neuro people, specifically in the stroke world, have decided, well, it's okay, but it's pretty blunt as a tool. It doesn't really get into the specifics of, honestly, what part of your brain is failing. It kind of gives you a generic overall picture. And there's ways that people have complained about it as well. So for example, if your patient is intubated, we don't actually know what your best verbal response is. So some health authorities have it in there that we would say, you know, GCS is, you know, 3 out of 15, 15 being sort of your best score, 3 being your worst. And that's maybe not true for the intubated patient. So some people try to qualify it with 3T, meaning 3-tubed. And so whatever your health authority does, I just think that no matter what, it doesn't matter what assessment tool we're doing, when you hand over from nurse to nurse, instead of this very vanilla report like ANO times 3 or ANO times 2, describe honestly what you see and be witty with how you articulate it. So if I were to move into a stroke assessment, maybe I'm going to assess a lot more specifics with my patient. But if I said, you know, they're weak on the right, that gives you a little bit of information. So you go in and you assess your patient and you're like, okay, yep, they're weak on the right, but could they have previously made a motor response that let them lift their arm against gravity. Well, you don't know because the nurse before you never told you. So I think if you have a finding that is deranged for a patient, you please need to follow up with really careful language about exactly what you see so that that handover nurse doesn't get lost in the mix of, well, is this different or not? Because now you're left trying to figure out, do I have to call the physician? Do I have to go to CT head? And you're left deliberating in your mind. So the more careful you are with that description, the better it is for everybody. And knowing your baseline is absolutely everything in a neuroscience assessment. If you've never met them before, family are a profound resource for us. And so that's so helpful to sort of then be able to go and ask, is this what they're normally like? Is this new? And anything that's abrupt, a new onset, I'm starting to worry as a nurse. And that's when I'm going to alert my MRP as to, okay, I got a new finding. I don't know what's happening, but we should probably look at, you know, if anything's changed from a sort of, you know, cerebral standpoint, or if there's something else that can explain that. And if somebody becomes decompensated from a neuro assessment, in the back of my mind, I run through a list of things of like, well, why would someone all of a sudden not perform as well as what they used to from a neurologic status? And so I have this sort of list in my mind of, well, oxygen and glucose are the only substrates of energy for a brain. So if they are deplete of those two things, there's no way that they're going to mentate well. So I need to know that they have a reasonable blood pressure and that that blood can reach the brain itself. For glucose, if we have less than 4 millimoles per liter, they're probably not going to mentate. They don't have enough available sugar for them to do all the things that they need to do. So always in a neuro assessment, the number one thing that the neuro team is going to ask you is, what is their blood glucose level? And it doesn't have to be fancy, just a point of care test. We can see hypoglycemia being an issue, but you can also see hyperglycemia being an issue. So if someone, you know, shows up with diabetic ketoacidosis, of course they're not going to mentate well either because they've got too much sugar floating around in their system. So we want to say for all neuro patients, keep them normal glycemic. That's kind of the hallmark rule. The other thing that I worry about is hypothermia. So for people, you know, found down outside, anyone with a temperature of less than 34 degrees Celsius probably isn't going to mentate well. So even in brain death, we want people to be warm so that we can make sure that the hypothermia isn't explaining why they have decreased mentation. So you have to be warm and dead before you're actually declared brain dead, right? That's kind of a vulgar way to explain it, but it is a rule of thumb that we go with. Then we move into the oxygenation status. So I, as an ICU nurse, get a ton of free information on my ABG. So I would look at electrolytes, like how much sodium is available, because we know that that's important for the action potential in the brain. And I also look at things like PaO2 and PCO2. So if I have absolute hypoxemia and my PaO2 is less than 60, of course, I'm going to start to wonder if that's what's causing them deranged mental picture or if they're hypercarbic. And so throughout COVID, of course, there are a lot of hypercarbic people who couldn't get their PCO2s down. So we had to probably, you know, ventilate for them to get that down, but it will cloud your neuro assessment for sure. And then we have other things like, you know, are they using recreational drugs or did we give them something that actually was a pharmacologic intervention that now clouds our neuro assessment? So for like, I think, whatever, early 2000s, I was on call for the NABISH study, and this was really trying to figure out, you know, in traumatic brain injury, how low should we drop somebody's body temperature? Because we know when they have a lower body temperature, they have less metabolic demand, and then maybe could the brain recover more. And so I got very tuned into, you know, sleeping in my apartment and then knowing like what helicopter sound was stars versus what was just a regular traffic helicopter or police helicopter. Anyway, then I would go in, I would meet this sort of major head trauma patient, and always the eMERGE nurse would push a benzodiazepine before they went to CT. It was kind of their habit. And that half-life of that drug was quite long, like 30 to 40 minutes, maybe up to 60 minutes for them to clear it so I could get a baseline neuro assessment. And it kind of drove me nuts because I was like, why did you do it? I mean, maybe they weren't even moving. Why wouldn't we have let them have the least amount of sedation possible? And then use only as necessary. And if we're going to use drugs that clouds people's mentation. You know, in neuro patients, we should probably, as best possible, avoid benzodiazepines unless, you know, they have alcohol withdrawal. So, or seizures. Those are kind of the two realms where I think that that's appropriate. But outside of that, I do think medications really blur our picture. So I'm a little bit trying to figure out, well, what was the med that was given and how long should it take it to clear before I believe if this is a primary cerebral insult that I'm worried about or if it's explained by a confounder of neuroassessment.
I find that really interesting. Can you tell us more about your involvement in that study and what you learned from it?
Yeah, well, they were trying to figure out, in traumatic brain injury, you have the primary insult and then you have this secondary cascade of inflammatory reaction that happens. So let's say you're walking down the street and you roll your ankle, you know, probably a couple days from now, you're going to have a really fat ankle. The same would be true for a cerebral insult. So let's say somebody takes a knock to the head. We know that sort of over the next 3 to 5 days, we're going to have peak inflammatory swelling. And so it will swell. One of the scientific questions was, if we reduce the core systemic temperature, could we reduce cerebral metabolic demand and therefore slow down that sort of inflammatory secondary brain cascade? And so they were trying to figure out, well, what temperature made sense? And for a while, you know, we dumped the temperatures quite low, and that led to all kinds of complications. You know, it suppresses your ability to mount reaction to infection even. And so secondary infections may have become more prominent in very cold people. So the whole trials were trying to figure out, well, how low should you go? And when is it beneficial? The World Federation of Neurosciences, I think, looked at that quite closely from making their recommendations. And they try to sort of figure out, when we're managing traumatic brain injury, you know, optimize the patient for oxygenation and electrolytes and all these things that we just talked about first. If they still look like they're not doing well, then maybe we could consider dropping their temperature or putting them into a pentobarb coma or actually taking them to surgery and allowing the, you know, sort of part of the cranial bone to come off so that they can swell more. But those things are place later on in our interventions when we're failing at just regular medical management. And so they kind of become like this Hail Mary effect where maybe before we thought it was routine and we should do it for everyone. So I think we've moved away from that. We don't dump the temperature as low as what we used to. So people are kind of more now focused, specifically in stroke, keep them normothermic. And you can see the trend, keep them normal glycemic, keep them normothermic. We just want them to be regular. But temperature itself, let's say I have a systemic temperature of like 36 degrees. In the cranium, there's no way for you to sweat or dissipate heat. And so the brain temperature is naturally always higher by like maybe 1.5 degrees Celsius. So if I have a core temperature of 36, I would assume sort of maybe my brain temperature is 37.5. And if they are hyperthermic, from a systemic perspective, we can assume the brain temperature is even more than that. So a lot of the guidelines now for neurologic insult kind of say, keep them normal thermic, use Tylenol to achieve that, or maybe sort of some external cooling methods in certain disease pathologies, not all of them, because we don't want the brain to actually get too hot. The last thing I think is a confounder is to always think about seizure. So for patients who have had you know, blood in the brain or pharmacologic intervention or hypoxia, seizure can become a true reality. And in the injured brain, maybe we don't actually even get convulsive seizures. Maybe we get non-convulsive seizures that are subclinical and there's an electrical storm going on in the brain, but we just can't see it physically. And so what they will do is pop leads onto a patient's brain and then just sort of figure out with electroencephalogram, do we see an electrical storm? And if so, maybe we can treat the seizure and then they'll wake up and start to mentate well for us. But in the back of my mind, when I meet these people, I'm trying to figure out, if you're a profound decreased LOC, can any one of those confounding things explain why you're not mentating very well? And the last thing I always do, this movie will bang it home for you. The Diving Bell and the Butterfly. Have you ever watched that movie?
No, I've never seen it. No.
Okay, well, this gentleman is like the editor of Elle magazine, and he has a pontine stroke. And so really sort of in the brain stem area strokes. And he can no longer open his eyes or defend himself or have any motor response. So if you go in there as a nurse and you're trying to say, hey, Mr. Smith, can you open your eyes? Well, no, he couldn't because he had a pontine stroke that rendered him unable to elicit a motor response. So everyone I meet, I don't care who they are, if they are decreased LOC, before I move into central pain, I lift their eyelids and I ask them, can you move your eyes right to left? Because sometimes the ocular motor movement is left for people. He eventually regains like the ability to blink, but then he blinks out this whole book. So if you're interested in learning about neuro in cooler ways than this podcast, that movie describes that sort of patient trajectory, but as well, he blinked an entire book himself with his occupational therapist. And unfortunately he, you know, does succumb to his injury, but I watched that movie on the airplane and bawled my face off. It is just an absolute profound testimony of like, what is it like to have a pontine stroke? And I think the stewardess thought me and my husband were just crazy people because we were crying our faces off at how sad that scenario was. But totally watch it or read the book, whatever you
like. Okay, yeah. Oh, put it on the list.
Put it on the list, yeah. So that's like a roundabout way to talk about GCS and, you know, a couple of things that I ponder for confounders in neuro assessment. But I guess we get then down to the point of like, well, when should we freak out and let the physician know that we're worried? And I think that anything that deviates from baseline, that's deterioration, is where I start to ask that question. If I can't explain, you know, why they behave that way, maybe the physician with neuro expertise will help me walk through that list. So I know in ACLS, we all know the H's and T's, but there are these kind of common things in neuroassessment too that are common confounders, and they can help you walk through that. So do phone them for that. But if it's an abrupt acute onset that is different than what you have been seeing for time, that's always a phone call to the physician. And I think that that's why it's so absolutely key to know your baseline assessment of the patient, because if you don't know what was truthfully happening, then you're going to be delayed in actually recognizing if there's derangement or not.
I think we forget, and this might sound silly, I think we forget that the chart, the main purpose of the chart is actually as a communication tool. I think we use it more as a legal document, which of course is really important, but I think unsurprisingly, like everything else in healthcare and maybe in life, it's all about communication, right? So if you can document your assessments well, that really helps your colleagues when they're taking over and finding, deciding if it's a new finding or, you know, just something you forgot to tell them in report. So I think you're so wise, Pam.
Yeah, it's such a true statement. And I love people. I think that, you know, our physio and OT colleagues are amazing at this. Mm-hmm. Nurses will be like, oh, they're confused, which is kind of generic, right? In what ways are they confused? And the OT and the PT are very specific about, you know, cannot do the following things, or they actually put in quotations what the patient said, so that you're like, oh, okay, this is how they're kind of failing in orientation or whatnot. But yeah, I think that for the neuro patient, like if you've got someone who's really acute for a neuro kind of perspective, bringing in friends is also helpful. Mm-hmm. And we used to do this all the time. Like we would look at cranial nerve number 3 and try to figure out pupillary reactivity. And if somebody sort of had like dark eyes and a sluggish pupil, you'd stare at them and be like, do you see anything? And so you would just scan your flashlight over those pupils all the time. And then you would get your co-nurse to be like, yep, do you see it, or am I making it up? So, you know, there's probably a lot of people hovering around that patient trying to figure it out. And that's when you learn, oh my God, do neuro patients have neuro breath? And I don't know if there's any publications on this. But if you
want to do one, Pam, let's do one.
I don't know. I'm going to dig around, because boy, will you never forget it. Like you'll never forget the smell of C. diff and you'll never forget the smell of neuro breath. These are absolute nursing truths, I think, in life. But yeah, so I think phone a friend if you feel like you're on the, you know, cliff of like, should I call the MRP or not? Maybe get a second assessment or ask your sort of clinician or PCC to come by and take a peek as well. But and if you can't describe it, I've had this where I've had patients, like I, you know, had one patient who had seizures, but all they did was sort of move a little muscle on the side of their sort of jaw. And that was the seizure, but I couldn't describe it well. So I would make the nurse come in with me and I would say, this is it. Like, when you see that, that's subcortical seizure. And this is what we've been doing as a result. And we would dose medications to sort of mitigate that seizure. But I think, you know, if you can't use your words, then show them physically. This is what it looks like. And this is how they've been for my entire shift, so that the new nurse doesn't have to sort of have this debate in their mind about, am I for real going to CT or not, to figure it out? Yeah. That kind of two-person handover. But it's hard, I know, because you've kind of got some shifts where one nurse has 12 patients. So that's a rate-limiting kind of factor. But ponder it, you know, if it ever comes up, if it's a handy sort of strategy. Yeah. What else are you pondering about neuro?
Well, I'm wondering, Pam, I'm wondering, we've talked, I'm weary of this because I'm an acute care nurse and so are you. I'm wondering if you could tell us a little bit, maybe about if I was assessing a patient who is a, I'll put it in air quotes, a non-neuro patient, so a patient here for another reason, how do you do a neuro assessment on that? And do you have any hot tips for people who might work outside of the hospital around neuro assessment?
Well, I feel like everyone's a neuro patient, as you know, so that's my disclaimer. I think that if you're working in a floor that feels like it's, let's just pick on orthopedics because that's your background. I still think when you walk in the room that every nurse should take the approach of head to toe. So of course you're going to do very focused assessment on orthopedics and, you know, CSWM and all those sorts of things that you're going to do for those patients, but you still get a reasonable amount of information from interacting with that person that you should still come away with enough neuro baseline information to know that was sort of what they were like at 8 a.m. and now at 12 and sort of noon, we find that they look quite different. So I think just good habits of like always talking to your patient and always trying to figure out if they have bilateral strength for motor power and sensation. And if they are aware of sort of their orientation, that's key. And I think every patient benefits from that. So I don't think it should be different. But for neuro assessment, like let's say you're on a neuro floor, of course we'll get nerdier and dig into it with maybe subspecialty tools or different things. But I don't see there being any different for that basic gut reaction about head-to-toe assessment, whether you're neuro or not. All those things should be done all the time. I don't know. Do you feel the same? I'm not sure.
No, I do think I feel the same. And I think we forget exactly what you're saying. We forget how much of the assessment that we do without knowing it. You know, you can do most of your assessment without touching your patient or listening to their chest or this, this, and this. And I remember I worked with a nurse who, she would get so grumpy. You know, sometimes you hear the phrase nurse intuition. And that was on our, you know, our medical emergency team criteria. If you had a bad feeling about your patient, you could call. And she would say, you know, there's nothing wrong with that, but it's not my intuition, it's my assessment skills. And I think there is a lot of truth. I do think I'm a believer in that as well. We just don't always know how. You look at your patient, you know something's wrong, but you don't always know how to put that into words. And you've seen it before and all of these things. So I think we are always assessing our patients and sometimes we just forget that that's what we're doing and that sometimes going in and chatting with your patient while you're giving them their pills and, you know, helping them get up and moving, all of that, those in-between moments are where you can do a lot of your assessments and dig a little bit further and find what you need to do. So it doesn't always need to be a formal, I'm coming in the room to do a head-to-toe assessment on you. I certainly feel very strongly that you should do that at the beginning of your shift, but that's not the only time that that happens, that you're doing that all through your shift, every interaction with your patient, whether you know it or not, you're assessing their neuro status is how I would say that.
I think that's so true. And like you say, there's this sort of repository of patterns that you you develop over your nursing career. So like, do you remember that sort of blank book that came out by Malcolm Gladwell?
Mm-hmm.
It was like these experts would make these blank decisions and know instantly if something was a true piece of art or a fake. And I think as a nurse, you sort of know if this is a true neurologic emergency or not in some of those scenarios. But the reason that we can't articulate that well is really because, you know, from a cognitive decision-making standpoint, a lot of things are non-declarative knowledge. So it's not explicit to us. We don't declare it, but we all know these things to be truths. So, you know, one of the hallmark examples of non-declarative knowledge is, you know, like I show you a watch and you know it's a watch, like it's the new iPhone, or like the new iWatch. But like, how do you know that? You can't go back and say, well, I just know, but that's the truth. You just know. It is this non-declarative process that your brain, as a nurse or a regular human being in the world now, knows to be true. And so never discount that. I mean, if we get into patterns of like biases that are sort of not accurate, of course, we need to break those habits. But some habits are good and they give us really good gut reactions that we'll never be able to explain. And it's only because we've built this repository of non-declarative things that exist in our long-term memory structure. So yeah, they're great, but they are assessment skills, like you say. It's just a different way of cognitive function.
What about, Pam, so if I'm a new nurse or an experienced nurse and I'm looking to find out more, if I've listened to this podcast and thought everything you said was really interesting, which I also would like to say I did think it was very interesting, can you point us, where are we supposed to go? Are we supposed to, do you have resources we could look for, or associations, websites?
Oh, for sure. Yeah. So Canada has a Canadian Association of Neuroscience Nursing. So that exists. The BC chapter is very strong. We have an amazing lead out of Vancouver, Trudy Robertson, who used to be the president there. So, but that organization kind of is the national nursing one that you should know about. There's also a World Neuroscience Federation. So you could do international if you're interested that way. I always tell people whenever I'm hanging out with them in neuro lectures that there's way cooler ways to learn about neuro. And so in my mind, I always look at sort of, you know, what's going on in social media or pop culture. And when I took this job is in stroke, I mean, I had a lot of neuro critical care background, but boy, was I green in stroke. So I had to sort of, I'm still learning a ton, like absolutely every day. And I'm so thankful for my team around me for the dialogue that happens, because I learned so much from, you know, case debriefs and all the things that we talk about in rounds. But I also learn a lot on Twitter. So I start following experts on Twitter, and they expose me to amazing sort of videos or infographics that all of a sudden make me have these light bulb moments of like, oh, okay, well, that's what's happening in this circumstance. So, and you get international experts on Twitter letting you know, like, what's the new research that they're digging into. And I love research because it's essentially you being curious about iterations of like, let's ask this question, let's dig into that more. This didn't work great. Let's think about how could it work differently or better. And they're constantly updating their thoughts on Twitter. And so you get this real time news feed on neuro in who you determine to follow. So I know, I think a lot of people in the tech industry think Twitter is dead, but from a health education perspective, I actually find it super helpful to follow these nerds on Twitter who are constantly posting, and I really like that. So yeah, find your passion and follow them. Like, whatever your passion is in nursing, it doesn't have to be neuro. You could kind of find it in any other realm, I'm sure, but that is been so valuable to me. And then, so of course I go into the, you know, what are the movies that are out there about neuro? Oliver Sacks was this neurologist who writes about all sorts of very cool patient encounters that he's participated in. And I like all of his books. I always have. I kind of liked them before I even went into nursing school. But then there's a Netflix one, like one of them is talking about this person who had a traumatic hemorrhage. And so it's called My Beautiful Broken Brain. So I did watch that Netflix series and I found it helpful. And there's a book called Left Neglected, and it's fictional, but they do a really good job of describing what would it be like if you had no idea the left side of your body existed. Like, you've got no left visual field. And so what would that be like? And that's the truth for some of our stroke patients. Like, we always sort of say, if no, they've got left side neglect or their left visual fields don't function, you could put like their world's favorite cupcake in front of them. And if they don't scan the room, they're not going to see the favorite treat on the lunch tray. So, you know, I like that story, and it's just so approachable for trying to understand what the lived experience is. So I kind of update my social media pop culture kind of list as things come out. But yeah, Brain on Fire was another one. Did you read that book?
I did read that. I had this patient that, I don't know when that book came out, a while ago. And I remember her husband sitting in her room reading that book while she was having the identical presentation in the bed. And that was just so, I went home that, I think it was a night shift I was working, and I went home and the next day I went out and bought the book and read it like in a week. I thought it was awesome. So interesting.
Amazing. Super interesting. Yeah. And those things, for whatever reason, stick in your long-term memory better than us just teaching a very boring lecture. Right. So I think it's the better way to learn, for sure.
And it's the way that we learn clinically too, because we're learning from patients and their experience, and that is how we remember, right? That's how we remember everything. We can point and say, oh, I remember that patient in room 10, and I did this and this and this, and these things happened that shift. I think we remember things in a narrative sometimes as nurses, and so it's helpful, I think, to take information that way too, or I found that for myself.
Yeah, absolutely. So true. Those episodic hallmark moments that you'll never forget. Yeah.
Yeah.
Every nurse has a great little list of amazing stories in their history that, you know, I love them. I love listening to those stories.
All right. Well, Pam, I think we're at our time. I know your time's precious, so I could keep you here all day visiting, but I don't want to do that. Is there anything you felt like you didn't get to say?
No, I think that's it. Thanks for the airtime on this. I really hope people walk away knowing, like, establish your baseline for a neuro patient. And if there's an acute abrupt change in any way, be able to articulate it well with language and then notify whoever can help you. And from a stroke perspective in interior health, I just have to say that the group we get to hang out with are so approachable. So please never hesitate to phone anyone.
And they can just find you in the directory then, Pam, if they need you professionally.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Okay.
And I'd love, you know, anyone to reach out anytime. And if we can, you know, update what we talk about in our talks too, you know, if things didn't land well or people have information for me to learn from, I like those kinds of feedback too.
Great. Thanks so much. Well, I had a really fun time, I must say. It reminds me, I think, obviously, my formal education and, you know, these unit orientations that you do, those are really important learning and ongoing learning, but I think so much of the things that I've learned and taken away in my career have been conversations with experienced nurses who come alongside you and sometimes tell you you're doing everything wrong. You know, you ding dong, what are you doing with this patient? And that is a lot of good learning, but also people will sit and discuss things with you. So thanks for doing that with us today, Pam. That's how it feels for me.
I appreciate it. And thanks for taking the podcast under your belt, because I think it's such a wonderful idea, and I hope it gains mass traction and that people are listening in and tuning in to all the topics ahead. I know I will. So thank you for putting out that effort. It's not something you had to do, but I very much appreciate that you are doing it.
Yeah, it's fun for me. So I'm excited to see. Maybe there'll be one or two people listening. Pam, that might be a win. So we'll see what the uptake is. But thank you to, if you're out there listening, thank you for your time. And we know your time is precious and you have a lot of places and things you could be doing right now instead of listening to this podcast. So thanks for joining us today. And special thanks to the Interior Health Professional Practice Office for supporting this project. And please feel free, we're happy to be reached by email at professionalpractice@interiorhealth.ca anytime regarding this podcast. If you have questions, complaints, or you have a great idea, we'd love to hear about that. And if you are an expert and you want to come and hang out for some time, I think the process is painless so far, and it's really fun. So please give us a shout if you have any ideas on how we can move forward with this work. All right, I think we'll leave it there. Hey, Pam, you're going to go about your day?
Awesome.
All right, thank you so much.
Thanks so much for the chat. Bye.